James, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. So tell us a little bit about yourself and who you help.
Hi, Seton. How you doing? It's great to be here. It's a real honour to be talking to you today. Look, my name's James Rosenwax. I live in Sydney. I work for a company called AECOM, and we're a big global infrastructure business, all right?
Nobody will know that name at all, will they?
I don't know. I mean, maybe some people will, maybe some people won't, but we're a global company. There's 50,000 of us around the world. We work on big, complex infrastructure projects. It's pretty exciting. And I've been with the company for 30 years now, basically since I was a graduate.
Hang on, because obviously your background, you actually started, were you running and that's been then absorbed into the business?
Yeah, I was a partner in a small landscape architecture, environment and planning business. So I'm a landscape architect by trade and now I work in an enormous, global enterprise, which is incredible.
And what's that sort of been like, the difference in starting somewhere that was small and quite specialised to now work in a company that's got so much diversity within the teams and so many resources to pull on from a whole international level?
Yeah, it's, to be honest, it's chalk and cheese. And I mean, it's not for everyone. And, you know, I had two business partners in that small business that became part of AECOM, and it wasn't necessarily for them. They're hugely talented professionals, but you've got to be built for a big infrastructure business like AECOM, and that has to be, what your career really, your pathway in working in a big place like AECOM. So in a small business, you're much more agile. You can make decisions. You have autonomy, but the downside of it is, well, firstly, you're running your own small business, which is risky. And secondly, the access to global clients and projects of scale that, a company like AECOM has with the balance sheet that we have and the reputation that we have. There's plenty of downsides as well. We're not as agile in AECOM. We are more risk averse, although we are changing. But we do have an incredible culture, and that's one of our differentiators. I love it.
And that's one of the things that's also led. So even if you're working in a 50,000 person organisation, every single department is different, every single region is different, and the experiences that you're going to get in those as well. So obviously coming from, you're a landscape architect, as you said.
Yeah, landscape architect.
Mm-hmm. So why don't you want to do that in the beginning?
Well, I mean, look, this is going back 35 years. I was good at art at school, and I was brought up in Sydney in the sandstone area, Hawkesbury River. Spent a lot of time on the Hawkesbury River, and I loved sandstone and I love Van Gogherers, and I felt that was the right pathway for me.
Oh, brilliant. And I think that's one of the great things about being a landscape architect is you just get this variety of where you can work and what you can do as well. So, different types of companies, but also different types of projects that you work on as well. So tell us a little bit about, you're the Managing Director for Building and Places in Australia and New Zealand. So what type of projects are you personally focused on?
I'm the Managing Director of Buildings and Places. That's one of the six business lines in AECOM, all right? We've got transport, energy, environment, advisory. I'm going to forget someone. Program management. Buildings is essentially, within AECOM, is focused on all the vertical infrastructure and the places around the vertical infrastructure. Yeah. So that could be buildings, so building engineering in a commercial building where I am right now, structural engineering, mechanical engineering. ICT, and then we do also, we play in all sorts of sectors. So the healthcare sector, we design hospitals. We're currently designing stadiums. Hobart Stadium, we're designing parts of that at Timber. We're working on arenas. We're working on the tender for a couple of arenas up in Brisbane, Arena, Gold Coast Arena, and importantly, we work in aviation as well too, which is a really important area for us to work. So airports are really going through a renaissance right now, all in every single state in Australia and also in New Zealand, because there's been a whole lot of pent-up demand after COVID and there's a real need to expand our airports and airport terminals as well to cope with the demand that they're seeing.
Right. So what demand are they seeing? Because that wasn't something I was necessarily as aware of. I knew, obviously, as assets, everybody is upgrading them. But what are we seeing from that of Australia, you said, post-COVID?
I think post-COVID, I mean, investment stalled, and, you know, our airports are growing really at a fast clip, you know, and when the investment stalls, you get pent-up need for the infrastructure, and that's really what we're experiencing now. It's just the fact that, you know, the investment stalled, it takes time to restart investment in infrastructure. And that's what we're seeing now is the restarting of all the investment that's happening to deal with the additional capacity requirements and the future capacity as well, because to develop an airport and expand a terminal can take 6 years.
Yeah.
Okay. There's a long gestation period. There's federal approvals. It's complex. They're often brownfield sites. We're having to knit into existing terminal structures. We're having to deal with all the stakeholders, the airports, air services, the airlines themselves. It is a complex process.
Oh, it's a very interesting business. And when I've spoken to people about airports as well, there's very complex contracts as well that they actually also have to dedicate to spending and actually upgrading all of that as well. And I'm assuming from civil infrastructure side, but also from the build side as well. So very interesting. That's why I love, you know, meeting with all these people and learning all of these different things. So obviously
there's one more. One more thing we do, which is really important, and you would have seen this in the budget yesterday. I mean, there is political instability around the world right now, and our government is very focused on defence and on AUKUS as well. And we're very, you know, in my business, up to 50% of the business is defence, all right, working with the national government and also working with the other global defence suppliers out there to help them develop their infrastructure needed to supply the defence industry as well. So we're working down in Osborne, in Adelaide, working on the AUKUS program for the submarines. So there's some really complex engineering that is happening right now around this country in defence. So
I think that's absolutely extraordinary. I think your story is also extraordinary because you always think of AECOM as, I suppose, more engineering, right? And it's more this. But then to have somebody who's been started as a landscape architect, I assume you didn't start your first company because you're not in there. You sort of came all the way up. So tell us a little bit about what your journey has been, because it seems like an exceptionally interesting one.
Well, I think landscape architects are really, I mean, we're well trained. Okay, we're trying to think beyond. We're trying to think really broadly, and we're trying to communicate. And we have landscape architects here, we have architects here, but it's not the majority of our business, all right? And now I lead a business of 650 essentially engineers, all right? And I'm a landscape architect. So I think that the journey really is that someone like me who's a landscape architect can think broadly, is intensely curious, understands how the world works, has to, as a landscape architect, you have to understand what a civil engineer does, what a structural engineer does. You've got to understand how to make it all come together, because often as a landscape architect, you're the lowest on the rung, all right? So you've got to keep abreast of everything else that's happening. And I think that's why I've succeeded in this place, because I can think broadly, I'm creative, I can communicate, I can lead teams, I can bring people together, I can set a vision and get people to rally around that vision. But so I don't practice landscape architecture anymore. All right. But what I do practice...
You don't get to do anything technical anymore, it would be.
Well, I do a little bit. I mean, I do have passion projects, and we can talk a bit about some of them later on. Right. But I think what I call myself now in a place like AECOM is a professional leader. And that's my profession, is leadership. And be it the business, I've evolved. I've done lots of different roles and remits within this organization. I've led lots of different challenges, business units, and each one presents a new challenge and a new opportunity for me to learn, to grow, and develop my skills as a leader to improve business performance, improve engagement, to improve our market position, whatever it might be we need to achieve. And
well, and I think that's always a really interesting thing, right? Everybody doesn't, it's just not like you go and then tomorrow you become managing director or an executive leader in a business. But you, throughout the period you're learning and probably also working in a small business, you have to think quite competitively and be thinking strategically. Now, not everybody has those skill sets, and that's, we can't have an organization full of chiefs. either. But I think it is, I generally find as people go through, you've got your technical years, you learn your trade, you understand, then you understand, okay, it's about working with other people. And as you said, I think landscape architects are always the last ones. And, you know, you're dealing with architects, you're dealing with engineers, you're dealing with all these people, and you're kind of having to configure it around what their needs are, but also get the outcome and think about the end users that you need as well. Mm-hmm. And then you start to progress into leading more people and doing that, and then progressing further into bringing in work, and then starting to look at how do we bring in other people who are thinking about that and what they're doing and how we're, you know, winning work, but also leading people and getting all these people to row in the same direction.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, the first 10 years is really that technical part, and the next sort of 30 years is really that people part, would you say? Yeah.
That's bang on. That's the exact time frames. Like, I did practice as a landscape architect for 10 years, and then I really, like, oh, you know, I'm a good landscape architect. I studied
I'm
it. I knew
you
it.
You are, unless you're good at your trade, either.
Yeah, but I realized that it takes you ten years to really work out what your strengths are, what you're really good at, and what you're not good at, and because no one has that insight, it takes 10 years to figure it out. All right. And it's only now, I'm 30 years in, that I know what I'm really good at. And I often ask people to figure it out. The way I ask them to figure it out is, you know, if you've got a pile of tasks every single day that sit there, which is the one you do first? And that'll often tell you, and I know what mine is. Mine will always be preparing for a presentation. It'll always be preparing for a pitch. It'll always be preparing for communication. You know, I get in early in the morning. I spend 2 hours, so 7 o'clock every morning, and I'll spend 2 hours just getting ready for my communications for the day. It's because what I love doing. And the last thing I will do will be look at the spreadsheet and try and figure that out and do some analysis of numbers. And, you know, I've got plenty of great people around me now. Yeah. But it's taken me a long time to really be able to say, this is what I'm good at and this is what I'm not good at. And I think it's only experience, 30 years of experience, that gives you the permission to do that.
Well, and I think it's what we call a strengths-based approach too, right? Like kind of your first 10 years, you kind of work through the hard parts, the stuff that you're not good at, but you got to learn, you got to do, right? And you got to build good habits, good routines. But really, I think the thing is that for all of our strengths, if we know where our strengths are, we're always going to flourish if we work to those. And if we work in teams, that's why I also sometimes talk about when we're building teams, we're not just building little blocks that are together. We're actually building puzzle pieces to make this beautiful piece that's going to come together. And so I think it's always vital that if you know innately, it's figuring out who you are and what you are naturally good at, knowing your weaknesses. And I think that's always a funny thing. You see people and, you know, they have these standard nifty things. What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? Like, nobody's going to say it to you. You've got to kind of interpret what they're going to say. It's more if people could actually identify, I'm actually really good at this. Mm. I can do this, but there are people who are doing that than me.
Yeah.
Then you can find those pieces of the puzzle that work together. But essentially, you don't necessarily, when you start to find those parts where you succeed, that's when life becomes very easy. And you're working to those things that make you good. That's why we never see a team is not made up of just one person doing something. Yeah. It's made up of other people who can do multiple things. And then, you know, we need the person who's the good at communicating. We need the person who's really good at detailing something, right? Yeah. We didn't have that person. The person who's communicating the project's not actually going to get done.
Yeah.
But innately, though, communication is obviously very important. And these days, I suppose, you know, you and I would be not that far off, but a lot of it is, and I'm finding this quite interesting because these days a lot of people obviously text. They think, half of the time if somebody's texting, I just call them. I'm like, if we're part of one or two texts, we're having a phone call because I'm going to sort this out.
Mm-hmm.
But innately our communication comes to writing. Whereas I think now we're also about to enter in a world of AI where, for example, you know, I've just downloaded Whisperflow today where you just literally push something and it can type anything out, particularly when you're starting to work with AI as well or coding. Mm-hmm. It's going to start doing that stuff for you. And I'm very interested how we've gone from an era about 30 years ago where most leaders would have a secretary who would dictate to now we've obviously got things where we're talking. But what that communication at the connection is very important too. Mm. So I think there's going to be some pluses in what we see that if you can dictate and then AI can write a lovely email to you that now we don't have to deal with as many problems, people not communicating and what they're feeling. But also we're never going to replace that picking up the phone and talking to people, that human connection. And I would be interested in, because I think one of the things is that we see different in infrastructure sometimes, or and then we see in buildings. So generally the property industry is a lot more relationship-led and is a lot of moving parts and things happening very quickly if you're leading a lot of the building services, versus the infrastructure side of things where we're seeing really long projects. You might have one client who might be the transport department. Are they things that, what are your observations from that as well? Because I'm quite interested in that from somebody who works in such a large organisation with different departments who have different client types and different ways of operating.
Well, I mean, I've run a number of businesses here, so I've got experience. I've been, you know, I've been across, I was a managing director here in this region, so I was across transport, energy, environment. So I've done it all. Okay. So I'm qualified to answer that.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Okay. I'm seeing that now. Now it's the story.
All right. So I've qualified, and buildings is definitely the trickiest business to run. All right. It is fast paced. You've got to have your wits about you to run a buildings business. You know, things can start and stop very quickly. It is definitely well ahead of the other sectors in terms of technology. Like, you think about where BIM started. BIM started in buildings, and it started in buildings for a reason, because of they're contained and there's, you know, repetition in them. All right.
Yeah.
An infrastructure project becomes much harder if we're dealing with high speed rail. We're all looking at high speed rail right now. You know, these are long linear pieces of infrastructure with lots of variables, soils that change, you know, everything, communities that change. So it becomes a lot harder.
Due to a technical interruption, we had to start this conversation again. So you were just mentioning that you'd obviously started working. Tell us a little bit about your background, that you've worked in both, leading both of those sectors as well.
Well, yeah, I have. So I've worked as a managing director across the whole region, and that required me to be across, you know, all our business lines. And so I've seen, you know, what the different sectors are like, you know, energy, transport infrastructure, and buildings, essentially, that they're all different, you know, and buildings is definitely fast-paced Wild West. You know, things happen quickly in buildings, and it's a much, much more difficult business to run buildings and places business than a transport business or an energy business, purely because there's so much you've got to do. There's so many different typologies. Okay, there's, you know, there's healthcare, there's defense, there's aviation, you know, and any good business will say, well, we've got to be disciplined in our focus. But the reality is, to run a buildings business, you've got to be working across multiple fronts with multiple clients to run a sustainable business. And that's hard, all right, keeping so many people focused and disciplined over so many fronts. In transport, nothing's easy, but transport, you're working with fewer clients, but the stakes are bigger. Okay, so the risks are bigger. We're working on the Western Harbour Tunnel right now, under Sydney Harbour, and if things go wrong on that, they're catastrophic. I mean, of course they are in buildings, but sometimes the budgets are bigger. That's a, you know, $9 billion budget versus a half a $1 billion budget on a building.
And I think that's always the interesting thing with MultDIS kind of organisation, right? So if you're just in building services, you've just got little fees. You've constantly got to be going. Things are on hold. Things are moving here and there. As you said, you've got to have mechanical engineers, vertical transport. You've got to have, you know, everything, electrical. You know, there's so many disciplines that you're working with in there as well. But then if you're working on transport, obviously you do have different disciplines within it, but you're going to have lead. You're generally the lead as well as the engineer, generally the lead consultant, whereas obviously in buildings, generally the architect is, or you're dealing with PM firm as well, who's going to be managing things through. You've got to be dealing with so many different clients, so many different stakeholders where work's going to come through as well. I often find that difference in the pace of people. It's also that kind of part. It's a bit like with interiors and architecture, right? So sometimes you've got architects who are working on things for 3 or 4 years, and then you've got interiors who kind of finish that job within 12 weeks, right? Yeah. There's just a bit of a difference in pace. But it also makes it really hard because it's like you're constantly fluctuating. And the ability to manage the business in the forecasting of what you're doing when that many moving pieces is happening is also a thing in itself. How did you go from doing that state management role to then taking on this national role, moving back to obviously more of what you're probably used to doing as a landscape architect and work in that world? And how was that experience?
Well, that's only been a new experience. It's only been 6 months because we've restructured our business now and to be not run our P&Ls through the regions, but to run our P&Ls through our business lines. And
yeah,
I mean, for me, it's, you know, a hotel needs a renovation every 7 years. So, you know, so does a career. Okay. And I'd been the regional managing director for 4 years, and that's what AECOM does. It is just a factory, a career factory. Okay. You've got opportunity everywhere. And so all of a sudden I'm turning my attention to a whole lot of new challenges and opportunities in buildings. And I've got to be honest, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled to be back because we're at a really important point in time in the buildings sector and places. Yeah. Because like I said to you before, buildings always goes first with innovation and technology. Then transport follows. So transport are now finally moving from doing 2D AutoCAD drawings to Revit drawings for their work, okay? And buildings obviously did that for 10. And that's not a boast. It's just a fact, okay? And the transport, we laugh about it here, okay? And with my transport
colleagues.
Most
landscape architects still aren't using Revit because it's expensive and it's hard to move around. And most engineers aren't too. Like it is changing on that side of things. Tell us a little bit about then what you see is some of the interesting parts and why it's so exciting to be back in building where you're seeing the industry going at present.
Well, I look at where things go wrong, and technology fixes where the risks are, and, you know, and that's what technology is for, solves problems. And for us in building engineering, it's always coordination between the disciplines. And no matter how hard we try, I've got electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, and structural engineers all sitting next to each other here. There's still human error in the design work we do. There's clashes, there's inefficiencies. And really, technology should be able to do a lot of that work for us.
Okay. Well, you've just opened up a very big yes. I'm very interested.
And we know that, and we know it's coming, and I think it's thrilling, and that's why I'm so engaged in the future in buildings, because we can really disrupt and change as an industry the inefficiencies that have been embedded in the way we deliver work for the last 20 or 30 years. And look at the building industry, okay? It hasn't innovated other than we've had a crack at DFMA and we've had a crack at modular development, but that's going to have to happen, and someone is going to lead this. Someone is going to make this happen and work, because we still can't build apartments for under $600,000 no matter where you are. Mm-hmm. And it's because labor's expensive, materials are expensive, and land is expensive. So there has to be, the only thing is time. So how to shrink the program, that's the only thing that's going to save money, the cost of materials.
Modular is doing so well in industrial, right? Yeah, or in certain areas. We had a fascinating interview with Dino Pindath, who's an architect who's specializing in this, from Adelaide, and very much talking about why can't we make houses like we make cars, and what those sort of parts are. So obviously from remote it works and it stacks up really well because obviously the costs are there, but in doing it in urban it's still not there because we just don't have the size and scale. And we had a very interesting conversation around why we want to make everything so bespoke versus how do we make something that can be multiplied. And I think we've seen some apartments sort of being built in that modular part, but at the end of the day, it is a big tower pretty much. You know, anybody works in multi-res, don't know how ever go at me, but it's Lego pieces and how you fit that in for the yields that you want to be able to attain. But I think the interesting thing is then what this is going to look like with technology and what it's going to do, right? And I think where this is going, and this is a big part of where my question is for people, and I'm glad you opened up that up, where do you see that from the engineering side of things? Because I think the big question is for the architects at the moment, I'm asking this, like, oh, yeah, and I think they're seeing it the design side. Whereas I see it should be on the technical side, and surely for the engineers, this is going to help you do a lot more from the calculations and being able to model options up. Is that something you guys are looking at present?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I won't say too much. I mean, you can Google AECOM and you can Google what we're doing with artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal. What we're seeing, the future is very bright. If I'm an engineer right now, it is the brightest stage in recent history because it's going to allow us to do so much more creative design work, allow us to optioneer, allow us to test more efficient outcomes for our clients and deliver much better outcomes for our clients. You know, an architect will change a building layout, it's unlocked down, and then how frustrating. The engineer will come back and say, well, it's going to be 3 or 4 weeks to change all our ductwork and our electrical layout and our reflected ceilings plan. And that's frustrating for an architect. It's frustrating for an engineer. It's frustrating for a client that's got to pay a variation to manually change and reorientate to deliver the best outcome. And what it does is it stifles innovation because at one stage you say, this is just taking too long. We need to draw a point and just proceed. Where we are. And I think technology is going to allow us to optioneer. It's going to allow the engineer to sit down, listen to a brief, and spend more time on listening, consulting with a client, understanding the brief, really teasing out of them what they really need and what outcome they're really after, and then using technology to deliver that outcome for them in a much more rapid way. And so it's not less engineers, it's going to be more engineers. Is what I'm saying because there's an absolute, there's a deficit of infrastructure that needs to be delivered around the world.
Yeah.
We simply do not have enough people right now to deliver what the globe needs. You know, and this is where technology is going to help us. We're going to be able to deploy more quickly. You know, look at the recent political conflicts, the infrastructure that needs to be rebuilt. It takes a lot to build. You know, there's a lot that has to be built in our cities. You look at our housing crisis in this country, the reality is we simply can't build quickly enough. Mm. I mean, people will obviously argue about the recent budget, but the reality is right now we're constrained by how quickly, you know, our productivity in the building sector.
Oh, look, and I mean, I think there's a downfall. I think on the front end side of things that we can design things quick enough, there's so much sitting in DA, right? The next thing is actually making it stack up. And a lot of that is then also the trades, right? You know, like even with all of these things, people forget, you know, silicon is made from petroleum. And so, you know, the simple things of what you need to make pipe to run electrical through, what you need to do for the plumbers to actually be able to put the pipe into the building or to whether that is vertical or whether it is, you know, just a typical house. Those costs are going up like 17% to 30%, right? Let alone the transport costs to get them here. So the supply costs are definitely hitting, and I think we're starting to see that now even seeping into the market and obviously interest rates. So we've got some twist points. Then now the point is going to be what those costs are. And 100%, I know so many building engineers who just sit there and go, bloody architects have just changed something again. This just means so much more work. And they actually prefer an ECI where they can get involved at the front end and actually have more of that involvement versus being the secondary to the design changes that come, sort of sticking it in and keeping this in mind. I think we're going to see, you know, I don't know how much that's also going to look like in a shift as well. I think we're starting to see those dynamics within the builders as well, builder developers, including more of that in their thinking earlier on and getting that cost structure. So essentially what we're talking about is the biggest challenge we've got right now is the cost of building. Technology is obviously one of those opportunities to be able to potentially reduce or be able to create solutions in a lot less time to be able to faster lessen those costs.
That's it. The only way we can reduce our costs is by compressing program and timeframes. And you know, the people like AECOM and big companies, we can invest in technology and infrastructure, but we're always going to be held up by the weakest link. And wherever that weakest link is, it'll be at a certain point in time where governments have to be able to keep speed with the way the private sector's moving, you know, with planning approvals and ability to take on artificial intelligence. So that's the future we have, and I think, you know, a productive, forward-thinking government will see this as a huge opportunity to drive productivity in our economy, and it's that's why I'm so excited. It's a really important time in history.
5 years are just, I mean, we had this before, like the change that we've seen in the last, we just did an earlier podcast with a director from Urbis and talking about urban plans and looking at that. What we're trying to build now for cities in the next 20 years, I don't know if we can see past the next 5 years in some areas and some challenges that we're having and what that looks beyond. Obviously, coming back out of the building side of things and talking about the infrastructure side of things, what are some of the biggest drivers that you're seeing on that side? So, you know, if you look at it, you were in New South Wales and ACT mainly. Let's look at it from an Australia and New Zealand perspective. What are some of the things, challenges and opportunities that you're seeing there as well?
Well, I mean, if you look around the country, the states, there's a pretty clear trends across the different states. And, I mean, the challenge is always funding and budget, okay? Western Australia, you know, it is. I think it's the only government that's in surplus right now, and they're able to invest in their state. They're building a metro, they're building defence facilities, shipbuilding facilities, and they're investing in critical minerals as well. So, WA is in pretty good shape from what we can see. You know, Victoria's had an incredible decade of growth. In infrastructure, they had the M80. There's a suburban rail loop, and there's a number of, and they went through a building boom as well, a commercial building boom. And I think a lot happened in Victoria. They're probably coming off that high they've been on. I mean, whether they are. And then New South Wales, we had new Labor government. We had 12 years, I think, or 10 years of a Liberal government, did some incredible things. And I think this Labor government now has realised, it feels like there's more happening in New South Wales than there was in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I feel like that investment.
That's what we're seeing. It's been a pretty flat few years here in New South Wales, and we're definitely seeing more activity. The government's stopped spending in transport, and they've had to start spending as well. Again, it's like the airport example I gave you. When you stop, demand gets built up pretty quickly, like a spring that's wound up, and we're seeing now that the government just simply has to invest in not major projects. They're not continuing the metro. They're completing the previous government's metro, but they are having to fix roads, maintain connectivity, increase the efficiency of trains and buses and all those sorts of things, which drives the engineering industry. So New South Wales is okay. Brisbane is going off its head right now with Brisbane 32, the Olympics. They've got Olympic fever. I was here in Sydney. I started my career in the 2000s or just before the 2000s. It's an incredible period. Everyone's, you know, building towards one goal, you know, which is hosting this, getting this flame into this city and hosting, which will be the greatest Olympic Games ever.
I'm based in Queensland. They've also had and I'm from Melbourne, so I don't know, we work nationally, so I've got a fair feeling of it, but also the change in government as well that's happened here.
Yeah.
I think Victoria is unlikely to, you know, you need to have good opposition as well. And yes, there is obviously interest rates that come into that of governments needing to borrow money, and that those costs obviously getting, particularly, you know, Victoria and New South Wales also, you know, took a bit of a harder hit with COVID and what needed to happen. Where is that? But I think you'll find in Queensland, you know, there's a very large confidence going on. There's a change in government, a government that wants to make development and make things happen and move through. We still need to, though, what happens, though, when you open those floodgates is suddenly you have a lot more competition in actually how you're going to get built. So it's all fine from the consulting side of things, but then there's only a certain amount of builders who can actually do, and that's probably one of the biggest challenges. And the opportunity I think we can see from Victoria and in New South Wales is actually more companies expanding, particularly on the building, the civil construction side, because it needs to be built and we need more trades. That's sort of where it is. So that's fascinating. Absolutely. Yeah. What are you seeing in New Zealand as well at the moment?
Well, I mean, New Zealand, you know, there's some positives in New Zealand, but there's also some negatives. They're seeing, you know, a net migration out of the country, a skills migration out, which is a real challenge for that country. And we've got a business over there, and we have people transferring to Australia to work on, you know, Brisbane 32, to work on arenas, on all these sorts of things. And whilst we keep them in our company, it is still sad to see young talent leaving that country. And so their challenge is they're a small population, I think the size of Sydney, running a whole country. And it's a it's a big country, and there's a lot of infrastructure you need to connect those people, keep people healthy and healthcare and pretty good facilities. And that's the challenge that New Zealand has. So they built a metro in Auckland. They had the earthquake in Christchurch, which is now completed. The city is vibrant and restored and really coming back to life. There's challenges in Wellington right now. There's decaying water infrastructure and road infrastructure, which is pushing up the price of rates and the cost of living. New Zealand's a really expensive place to live as well. We think Australia's expensive. New Zealand's expensive as well. And then, you know, healthcare. So they're now focused on healthcare. And building roads. They're finishing the metro now, so they're now focused on building roads and healthcare. And that's what we're seeing. So it's definitely not boiling over with work over there, but the economy is ticking on, but it's no Brisbane at the moment.
Oh, look, and I mean, the thing is, though, I think everybody got very excited about Brisbane, though, but at the same time, it had to flow through. Right, you know, specs and depends again, whether you're in building or infrastructure. But yeah, it'll be interesting. I think, you know, I think now the budget's come out, some people pause. We're at the end of financial year when we're recording this, it'll probably come out in July. There's going to be some changes and things flowing as we go through. Excellent. Now, just to finish off, we've had a bit of a very interesting conversation of future in regards to if you were a graduate or somebody going through their career, we had a bit of a conversation about yours and that emergence of where we see. What are the things that you would be telling people to be focused on in growing their skills and what they should be focused on in continuing for the future?
Well, I think the 10 years we talked about of learning your trade is really, really important. And just to be patient with that 10 years and realize you're not going to know everything in 10 years. So do take on as much as you possibly can and, you know, make that your first horizon, okay? It's a 10-year horizon to really understand who you are professionally. And take on, you know, get out of your comfort zone. Take on things that you wouldn't have normally taken on. Build your interpersonal skills and your networking skills. I found that really hard. I guess I'm an introverted extrovert, but I've had to learn it. Okay, I've had to learn how to communicate. I've had to learn how to public speak. I've had to do things I wasn't comfortable doing and have confidence that you can learn it, okay? Even if you are an introvert, you can learn how to network and how to be able to, to work across a number of fronts. It's just hard. It'll take a lot of energy out of you, but you can do it and you should do it in this age of AI because you're going to have to be across many fronts and be curious and be able to interpret things to brief the machine as best we possibly can. So that'd be my advice. I'd be very positive. You're not going to have to do a lot of the shit stuff we used to have to do. You know, I used to work on tracing paper, cutting out labels, you know, to put in the photocopier. You don't have to do any of that. You know, door schedules for architects, everything in the past. All right, you're going to get to do the fun stuff and make the machine do it. All right, and then review the machine's work and then make it do it again till it's better. And that's hugely exciting. So don't be scared about it. Get in there and make the most of this incredible era that you've walked straight into.
Absolutely. I mean, it is going to be an era where we can use machines, but we're still connecting with people. And at the end of the day, people are who actually makes the project happen. You're not going to be seeing robots doing things. You're interacting with people and understanding that. So brilliant. Thank you, James, so much for your time. Fantastic insights. Great conversation.
You too. I appreciate it, Seton. And I really enjoyed the conversation and looking forward to seeing the finished product.
Yeah. What a fascinating conversation and great insights that James has, both about working in large organisations, small, as well as working across different areas in infrastructure and building as well. It's going to be very, very interesting what is going to be happening in the differences and the growth that we can see in the changes that AI is going to make ahead. Keep posted as we might have some interesting insights coming up in the future.